Hello and welcome to this Building Wealth in an Uncertain World podcast discussion sponsored by PSG Wealth. In today's discussion, we're going to be diving into the biggest forces shaping the investment world right now, from shifting U.S. fiscal policies and the AI revolution transforming industries to the rise of cryptocurrencies and the evolving dance between public and private markets. Our goal is to unpack these complex trends and explore what they mean for your portfolio. Get ready for what looks to be an insightful conversation that cuts through the noise and help you make smarter real-world investment decisions in an uncertain landscape. My name is Buliwa Gabaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail, and I'm looking to be your host for today. And joining us is Adrian Parsky, is the Chief Investment Officer over at a PSG Wealth. Adrian, always good to talk to you. I think where we should begin is maybe you highlighting for us what are the three main areas of uncertainty that are currently impacting those global markets.
Hi, Madiwa. It's good to be on with you, and hello to everybody listening in. Looking forward to the session today. Yeah, I think there's a lot happening out there at the moment. And I think the conventional conversation is we talk about some of the geopolitics and the wars. We talk about tariffs and those kind of things. But for us, there's so many things actually that you need to sort of keep your finger on the pulse that sometimes it's good to form a kind of a mental framework for what are really the key drivers. And it's a similar process that we follow when we look at companies as well. There's so much happening in operations around the globe and new products and things. But sometimes it's really good to just understand what the key drivers of the business are and then trying to figure out how those things are moving in which direction and what are the things that impact them, and then sort of bucket it from there and then create some structure around analysis and conversations as a team. So I mean, if we follow a similar process, I think the three key areas for me at the moment that I think could have a significant impact or will most likely have a significant impact on investors over the next 10 years, and some of it will happen sooner and some of it potentially a bit later, is the first would be US fiscal strategy. And yes, we have seen a lot around tariffs. We've seen a lot around the gold price. We've seen a lot about the bond market. We've seen a weakening dollar. But all these things can be bucketed into that US fiscal strategy discussion. There's a reason why Trump is following this process on tariffs, and it has a lot to do with US fiscal strategy. And the bond market is getting concerned about the sustainability of US finances, which is why the bond market is starting to signal, let's have a look. And gold markets are also moving in a direction because of what bonds are doing, and the dollar's sort of moving in tandem with those things because those three are sort of joined at the hip to a certain extent. The second one would be obviously AI. This is a huge theme. It will have a significant impact on most businesses, if not all. But the other side of the coin has historically been, let's look at valuations. They seem to be getting more expensive. And guys who have a conservative risk appetite from a valuation perspective have really been on the short end of the stick because the stocks have just been getting more expensive and they've been managing to grow their earnings. But for me, I think the conversation needs to evolve a little bit and start to look at what's happening in the technology capex cycle. So it sounds very complicated, but essentially we need to look at how much money they're spending on capital and why, and what is the significant impact on that in terms of profitability and the expected future returns on those things. Because if we have failures in that environment, it will have a significant impact and could potentially lead to something similar to what we saw in the dot-com cycle. So that's where the risk is for me. It's all about going back to capex. And we can talk a little bit about the specifics a bit later. And then the third thing would be just broader investor behavior. We've created an environment globally, but especially in the US, which is flux with capital, very loose conditions in reality. Actually, interest rates are coming down, albeit slowly, a lot of money in circulation, very tax friendly. The government has essentially opened the checkbook to help consumers, and consumers have a lot of money and they're willing to you know, take various swings at various capital markets. And it's no longer a conservative environment where people appreciate that certain assets are risky and could have detrimental consequences, because most things are just going up. And even for a very nervous investor, they must be looking at the stock portfolios and thinking, I am a fantastic investor because most of the things I invest in are up 50, 60, 70%, whatever it is. And I think that's incredibly dangerous to have that element of complacency. It opens new markets. It opens a door to a feeling of invincibility, which I think is incredibly dangerous. And it pulls in investors into areas of the market that can have very detrimental consequences for them over the long term. And if we are to see a blow up in certain areas, especially some of the less liquid areas of capital markets, then investors will be caught in that space. And then you could make an argument that maybe the technology capex cycle and the investor behavior elements are sort of related, because the same level of speculation that we see on the investor behavior side in some of the more adventurous asset classes, you know, that speculation has also driven some of the technology hype forward as well. So investors are quite happily speculating about the future at the moment, thinking that good times will continue into perpetuity. And I think that is a dangerous game to play.
Maybe we can actually drill down a bit further into some of those aspects around the technology and specifically artificial intelligence. You touched on it in your second and also the last point just now around some of those capex cycles and the like. You even brought up the dot-com bubble, because some people have likened what's going on right now around AI to the turn of the century and all the hype that was around that dot-com bubble. Other people have gone so far as to say this is a step change and that this is the real fourth industrial revolution. Some maybe even saying a fifth or a 4.5, whatever, right? It's definitely a mega trend and it has driven up valuations in some very interesting ways. So on that front, right, how is that AI investment boom shaping corporate and consumer spending patterns?
Yeah, I think at this stage, I mean, there's no denying that the artificial intelligence movement will be something that will affect the economy and businesses around the globe in a certain way. From a productivity and efficiency perspective, it seems to add a lot of value, and there's a lot of benefits to be harvested out of this new technology. The thing that concerns me is more from the perspective of an investment manager. And yeah, it comes back to the capex cycle. So maybe just to touch on the basics of this is essentially the amount of money that's being spent on capital in terms of new infrastructure, equipment, whether it's data centers, whether it's robotics, all those things. Chips in particular is obviously quite important at the moment. And where the mindset seems to be is the one who spends the most will be at the front of the race and will ultimately benefit the most. So there's a race to spending. But spending doesn't come from nowhere. That money needs to come from somewhere. And then you need to still earn a return on it. Otherwise, you're going to land in a problem. And here's where the accounting gets quite interesting. So if you were investing in a new plant, for argument's sake, if we look at a typical capital intensive business, it's not expected of you to pay cash for that and then expense it into your income statement immediately and you have a negative earnings year because you spent a lot of capital. Instead, what happens is you have a big capital layout for something that's expensive. You can then put it on your balance sheet as an asset, and then you can depreciate it over time in your income statement, which is obviously less harsh on your headline earnings at the end of the day. But now there's two problems. It affects your free cash flow, and that's why we think we need to look at free cash flow of these businesses very carefully versus headline earnings, because the headline earnings concealed some of the expenses that are imminent, the amount of depreciation that's on your way. So if you look at a typical chip, for example, if you buy an NVIDIA chip, the view is you typically depreciate that over 5 years. So instead of, say, the chip is 100 Rand, instead of expensing all of that in this year's financial statements, you put it on the balance sheet and you depreciate it over 5 years, for argument's sake, say 20 Rand a year. But The problem is for this year, you might think, okay, but there's still another 20 Rand coming next year and the year after that, et cetera, for the next 5 years. But now the problem is with where the CapEx cycle is, it's accelerated to such an extent that there's multiple items for depreciating following over multiple years, because they're not just spending this year. You're starting to depreciate what you bought last year and the year before that. And next year, you will appreciate maybe 4 or 5 years worth of CapEx that you spent over that cycle. And then the other risk is that because NVIDIA is releasing chips now, and they coming to a point where they want to release chips every 18 months in terms of necessitates an upgrade, it essentially means the existing lifespan of the asset is no longer 5 years. It's maybe only 18 months. So are they sufficiently depreciating that? Will they be forced to depreciate it quicker, which will have an impact on the headline earnings? So you've got to have a careful look. You say, but maybe are they really spending that much money on CapEx that it can impact profitability? And to give you an idea, the CapEx of the Mag 7 going back to 2014 was $23 billion. This year, they'll most likely spend more than $300 billion on CapEx, which is about half the bottom line, half the profits that they are currently making. So it's an enormous bet that they're taking on capital and capital's ability to generate revenues for them going forward. And even if there's just a minor miss in terms of the profitability that comes through, the consequences could be quite severe because you've got depreciation charges coming for the next few years, whatever the weather. If your top line suffers for whatever reason, or you're not making profits for whatever reason, you still are going to have that depreciation. So you could end up in a very ugly situation. So you've got to be careful that you don't overcapitalize on something so you don't run into an issue. And I mean, we saw now just the other day, Meta's coming out. They want to spend $65 billion on CapEx next year. I mean, that's a tenth of the profits that's currently being made in Mag 7 stock. So it's meaningful spend. And we're getting a bit jittery to say, well, for them to make an adequate return on capital, it have to be a significant number. Otherwise, the depreciation cost is going to be too excessive for them to absorb. So I think there we might run into an issue. The extent of spending is just so excessive that the odds are becoming incrementally less likely that you will reach the required rate of return. And obviously, each of these Mag 7 companies think, but my situation will be different. I will be able to get the return, but not everybody will be able to get the return, which then introduces some other risks as we'll start to see some of these companies not succeed on that front.
Adrian, maybe just as a quick follow-up to what you're saying about these spending cycles and how things may be expensed down the line and the impact that it may have, especially on the bottom line. A lot of the spending that we are talking about, and I like the fact that you used the example of Meta, a lot of the spending that's being made in AI admittedly is concentrated, you know, more or less in places like the United States. But from a transmission effect point of view in the rest of the market, how do you think that type of spending or those cycles will affect maybe either the broader market or, you know, an investor who's sitting here in South Africa? Perhaps this is that onshore, offshore, you know, discussion rearing its head again.
Yeah, it's actually quite interesting because, I mean, a lot of the capital spend seems to be headed into NVIDIA's pockets as the primary chip manufacturer, which is great for them while things last. But at the end of the day, the corporates engaging in this investment needs to ensure that they can get a return on investment. And they're going to have to rely on the broader economy from the consumer, which is a big portion of the US. I mean, we mentioned this before, it's about 70% of GDP in the US. So if you don't engage the consumer on that front, it becomes a challenge. And even if we look at what some of the other parts of the economy are saying in terms of what they're willing to spend on AI plans of their own, which will help recover some of this CapEx, I mean, retail and consumer product companies plan to spend around 3.3% of their revenues on AI this year, which is largely insufficient at this stage to fully offset all the costs associated with it. And if you look at what consumers are spending on AI, it's around 1 to 2 billion globally, the last number that we saw for 2023. So there hasn't been large-scale adoption, and a lot of this is free to use services at this stage. So they're going to have to find a way of monetizing this into the consumer world. And then also, if we look at some of the other industries, they're going to have to find a way to increase the spend on AI. So maybe in a similar vein to where the Mag 7 companies are competing on spending to get ahead of things, we might see something similar in the healthcare space, for example, where people are spending more and more money on AI to stay ahead of things. If that doesn't materialize, there might be a problem there.
All right. I think that helps us to understand what's actually happening. And it will be interesting to see how some of those spending patterns, you know, do then filter out into the rest of the broader market. Now, outside of the world of AI, another, you know, mega trend or something that has been trending over the last couple of months and years actually is around cryptocurrencies. And especially in the last year or two, there's actually been, you know, quite a bit of a rally in that particular space. What role does cryptocurrency play as far as you can see in today's investment landscape?
Yeah, I think it's a really difficult one. I mean, you can see it's an area that's really full of speculation at the moment. I mean, the total crypto market now is just under 4 billion, which is meaningful. Or not 4 billion, 4 trillion, apologies, in US dollars. And I mean, that's a meaningful amount of money that's going into this environment. So, you know, you've got to ask, what is the motivation behind the usage? And from a financial planning perspective, what we think is a good approach, and I think is a sound way of going about it, is identifying what it is that you would like to achieve. So you say, I need to achieve inflation plus 6%, for example. How do you incorporate something like cryptocurrency to tie back to that? So as a financial planner or wealth manager, how do you use crypto to say, well, if we add 5% of crypto, that will give you X percentage of that? It's very difficult. We don't know what crypto is going to do. It could double overnight. It could go to almost nothing overnight. So from that perspective, it's pure speculation, which we think isn't ideal from a financial planning perspective. Ideally, what you would want as part of a financial plan is something that's quite reliable in terms of forecasting what you could get in return. So in crypto, as I say, that's not so great, but that doesn't mean you can't take informed risks. So if you think about equity, which used to be the risky asset class, we think equity is an asset that has exhibited quite stable long-term returns. If you think about it, it has a very good track record of delivering, in the South African context, for example, inflation of 6 or 7% over the long term. And there's reasons for that, because it's ultimately linked to corporate earnings, and those corporate earnings are underpinned by the inflation numbers and consumer spending growing and the economy growing, even albeit slow. There's things that underpin it. So for that to go away, it means growth will have to completely disappear. We might have to see some shrinkage, no inflation, and all those things are unlikely. So, and hence it becomes a more reliable asset class over time. It might require a slightly longer investment horizon, but you have a reasonable idea of what this will achieve over the long term, where you don't have this in the crypto market. So it baffles me a bit that you see that level of adoption of the asset. And you can say, well, you know, maybe it's largely speculative retail investors who don't follow a plan. But we have seen the asset class creep into the offerings of some of the other wealth manager businesses locally and abroad, which, to be honest with you, baffles me completely. I don't know how you convince someone that you can use this to achieve a specific targeted return.
When it comes to, I guess, moving forward in that particular market, it will be good to see how things progress. I'm very keen to see whether or not some of the predictions around crypto are going to come to fruition. Also interesting to see some of the movements in the market, fixed income versus equities, and how some of that traffic seems to have filtered into the crypto markets earlier in the year where we saw the tariffs. So it will be an interesting one to see how things go. The other one, though, is how are public and private markets performing and interacting in 2025? I think this helps to bring quite a few of the elements that we've been speaking about through the discussion together.
Yeah. again, a really interesting area because, I mean, the US makes for a really good case because they've got more developed private equity markets. But if we look at what we see in that environment, it's something quite similar to what we see in South Africa. So in terms of JSE or publicly traded equities, public equities, there's a sharp decline in what's available on most indices across the globe. So it's not just South Africa that's seeing delistings and fewer options available. It's something that's been happening in most exchanges around the globe. I mean, if you think back to the early 2000s, there were around 8,000 companies listed in the US, and today we're looking at around 5,000. And at the same time, we've seen private equity adoption, although that was largely in the institutional space for either larger clients or pension funds or, you know, these large university endowments and those kind of things. And now the narrative that's coming out from the private equity businesses is that they so-called democratizing these investments, making it accessible to smaller investors or investors with smaller capital bases. And the reality is that while this is happening, we see two meaningful things. Some of the pension fund investors and larger endowments are starting to disinvest from these investments, and they're complaining about liquidity issues and the long time it's taking to disinvest from those investments. And at the same time, we also see, somewhat ironically, because most people think that private equity make for better investments than elsewhere, but if we look at the S&P 500 and if we compare that to private equity, on aggregate, interest as a percentage of revenue is higher for private equity, is about 4% versus 1% for the S&P 500. If we look at the average interest rate that these companies pay, for listed companies, it's about half versus what private equity pays. So in the US, S&P 500 company pays around 4%, the private equity business pays around 8%. And the combination of those two things means it's a significant headwind for earnings. And you can see the EBITDA margins for private equity businesses are only 7% compared to 25% for S&P 500. And then if we look at the free cash flow margins for private equity on aggregate in the US, it's only 2%. And yet we see it being democratized and being marketed to retail clients. So that's probably not a great idea if overall private equity portfolio companies are smaller, more leveraged, pay higher interest and have lower margins than public companies. Then investors should actually just stick to the conventional things that have more transparency and actually are performing better. But yet investors seem to have this excess capital and this feeling of invincibility because everything that they've invested in over the last few years have gone up. And they quite happily take risk. And we think that cycle of behavior is probably peaking as well. And unfortunately, things can end quite badly if too much speculative behavior is embraced.
Perhaps as another quick follow-up to everything that you're saying, one of the themes that I am sort of picking up from what you're talking about, Adrian, the aspect around speculation. Usually we find ourselves in a speculative bubble around maybe a specific theme, a specific asset class. But in this particular case, am I correct in saying that we have a number of speculative situations all occurring at the same time?
You know, 100%. It's actually out of control to my mind. We mentioned the conventional things. I mean, even in conventional markets like listed equities, we see more speculative behavior. Investment horizons are getting shorter. Holding periods are getting longer. People feel they can trade stocks actively, that kind of thing. And then you've got some of the newer things or alternative things that investors think that they can dabble in safely without knowing what the details are. And this is the private equities and the hedge funds and structured products and those kind of things of the world. Not all of them are bad, but the thing is you've got to be aware of the risks. And from a financial planning perspective, you need to ask whether this is really suitable as a financial planning vehicle or tool. And then on the other side, you see a whole range of different things popping out from SPACs to leveraged ETFs. You can say there's been a lot of innovation in the financial markets over the last few years, but that's a direct function of all the loose capital that's around. And financial institutions are competing for capital, which means they need to innovate and put new things down. But when that gets out of control, you end up with a lot of speculative product that's accessible to anybody, whether you are a sophisticated client or not. And then it's a bad combination having a client that's not fully aware of all the risks using things that have more risks. Can't see how that's going to end well. But I think more broadly, you know, why is this happening? I think it's a direct consequence of just a lot of debt from the US government, and that has found its way into consumer pockets. And then at the same time, we see a lot of M2 actual money in circulation in the US as well. So proliferation of these types of products and speculative behavior, because clients feel, or investors, even amateur investors, feel somewhat invincible. You can buy anything these days, it's going up. But that has consequences. It won't last forever. And eventually, you know, it reminds me of the quote that says, when the tide goes out, eventually the tide will go out. And what are we going to be left with? It remains to be seen.
Yes, indeed. It does remain to be seen how things progress over time. And, you know, likely a lot of discipline will have to be practiced by people to actually make sure that they don't get hurt when the tide does indeed go out. So to round up the discussion and end off then, Adrian, what is the optimal approach to actually building wealth amid this high uncertainty environment?
Yeah, I think it comes back to an extent to a little bit about what we discussed last time around in terms of overreaching. I mean, that is sort of synonymous with speculation. So people just trying to go after more returns than what they actually need, not realizing what the potential risks are of doing that. If you go through a financial planning process and you've identified what you actually require, then it's easier to say this is the most suitable asset class that will most reliably deliver on what you need. So I think that part is really component. In the absence of a clear goal, and if the need is purely just get me the best return possible, that type of thing is what's going to land you in a situation that you'll regret later, I think. So as simple as what it is, be clear in your mind as to what you are actually trying to achieve. Find something that's going to reliably get you there at the lowest level of risk possible. And in some cases, if you've got a more ambitious requirement, which you can still accommodate, it's not to say you need to be super conservative in everything you do, but even if you have a somewhat ambitious target in terms of what you need to generate as a required rate of return, still go for something that has demonstrated its worth over the long term through multiple cycles and has an element of predictability to it, as opposed to a narrative or just very strong sentiment or a story of it's going to be the future. No one can predict the future. And I think that's where we need to be careful.
All right. So on that note, that's where we end off today's discussion. It has been a great one talking about building wealth in an uncertain world, sponsored by PSG Wealth. Thank you so much to Adrian Parsky, is the Chief Investment Officer over at PSG Wealth. Adrian, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Madiwa. Thank you to all the listeners.
I've been your host, Pudiwa Gawaza, of the Business Day and Financial Mail. Remember that you can subscribe for free episodes on iono.fm, Spotify, Play.fm, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your podcasts.